I know you won't understand this, but I have been doing everything in my power to keep you and yours safe. You don't understand what you've waded into, and you are fucking things up. I wish you had had the moral courage to come to me with this before you ran off like a horny 16-year-old with James Holden. Honestly, if there was a better way to destroy any professional credibility you once had, I can't think what it would have been. I put you on the Guan Shi Yin to take you off the board because I knew that things were about to go hot. Well, they are. Only you're in the middle of them, and you don't understand the situation. Millions of people stand in real danger of dying badly because of your egotism. You're one of them. Arjun's another, and your daughter. All of them are in threat now because of you. In the image, Ehrenreich clasped his hands together, pressing his knuckles against his lower lip, the platonic ideal of a scolding father. If you come back now, I might be able to save you. Not your career, that's gone, forget it. Everyone down here sees that you're working with the OPA and Mars. Everyone thinks you've betrayed us, and I can't undo that. Your life and your family, that's all I can salvage. But you have to get away from this circus you've started, and you have to do it now. Time's short, Christian. Everything important to you hangs in the balance, and I cannot help you if you don't help yourself. Not with this. It's last chance time. Ignore me now, and the next time we talk, someone will have died. The message ended. She started it again, and then a third time. Her grin felt feral. She found Bobby in the ops deck with the pilot Alex. They stopped talking as she came in, a question in Bobby's expression. Avasarala held up a finger and switched the video feed to display on the ship monitors. Ehrenreich came to life. On the big screen, she could see his pores and the individual hairs in his eyebrows. As he spoke, Avasarala saw Alex and Bobby grow sober, leaning in toward the screen as if they were all at a poker table and coming to the end of a high-stakes hand. All right, Bobby said. What do we do?
We break out the fucking champagne, Avasarala said. What did he just tell us? There is nothing in that message. Nothing. He is walking around his words like they've got poison spikes on them, and what's he got?
Threats. No one makes threats.
Wait, Alex said. That was a good sign.
That was excellent, Avasarala said.
And then something else, something small, fell into place in the back of her mind, and she started laughing and cursing at the same time.
What? What is it?
If life transcends death, then I will seek for you there. If not, then there too, she said. It's a fucking haiku. That man has a one-track mind and one train on it. Poetry. Save me from poetry.
They didn't understand, but they didn't need to. The real message came 5 hours later. It came on a public news feed, and it was delivered by Secretary General Esteban Sorrento Gillis. The old man was brilliant at looking somber and energetic at the same time. If he hadn't been the executive of the largest governing body in the history of the human race, he'd have made a killing promoting health drinks. The whole crew had gathered by now. Amos, Naomi, Holden, Alex, even Prax. They were sandwiched into the ops deck, their combined breaths just slightly overloading the recyclers and giving the deck a feeling of barn heat. All eyes were on the screen as the Secretary General took the podium.
I have come here tonight to announce the immediate formation of an investigative committee. Accusations have been made that some individuals within the governing body of the United Nations and its military forces have taken unauthorized and possibly illegal steps in dealing with certain private contractors. If these accusations are true, they must be addressed in the most expedient possible manner. If unfounded, they must be dispelled, and those responsible for spreading these lies called to account. I need not remind you all of the years I spent as a political prisoner.
Oh, fuck me, Avasarala said, clapping her hands in glee. He's using the outsider speech. That man's asshole must be tight enough right now to bend space.
I have dedicated my terms as Secretary General to rooting out corruption, and as long as I have this gavel, I shall continue to do so. Our world and the solar system we all share must be assured that the United Nations honors the ethical, moral, and spiritual values that hold us all together as a species. On the feed, Esteban Sorrento Gillis nodded, turned, and strode away in a clamor of unacknowledged questions. And the commentators flowed into the space, talking over each other in all the political opinions of the spectrum.
Okay, Holden said. So, did he actually say anything?
He said Ehrenreich is finished, Avasarala said. If he had any influence left at all, that announcement would never have been made.
God damn, I wish I was there.
Ehrenreich was off the board. All that left was Nguyen, Mao, Strickland, or whoever he was, their half-controlled proto-molecule warriors, and the building threat of Venus. She let a long breath rattle through her throat and the spaces behind her nose.
"Ladies and gentlemen," she said, "I have just solved our smallest problem."
Chapter 46. Bobby. One of Bobby's most vivid memories was of the day she got her orders to report to the 2nd Expeditionary Force Spec War Training Facility. Force Recon. The top of the heap for a Martian ground pounder. In boot camp, they'd trained with a Force Recon sergeant. He'd been wearing a suit of gleaming red power armor, and they'd watched him demonstrate its use in a variety of tactical situations. At the end, he'd told them that the top 4 boots from her class would be transferred to the Spec War facility on the slopes of Hecate's Tholus, and trained to wear the armor and join the baddest fighting unit in the solar system. She decided that meant her. Determined to win one of those 4 coveted slots, she'd thrown herself into her boot camp training with everything she had. It turned out that was quite a lot. Not only did she make it into the top 4, she was number 1 by an embarrassing margin. And then the letter came, ordering her to report to Hecate Base for recon training, and it was all worth it. She called her father and just screamed for 2 minutes. When he finally got her to calm down and tell him what she was calling about, he screamed back for even longer. "You're one of the best now, baby," he'd said at the end. And the warmth those words put in her heart had never really faded. Even now, sitting on the gray metal deck in the dirty machine shop on a stolen Martian warship, even with all her mates torn into pieces and scattered across the frozen surface of Ganymede, even with her military status in limbo and her loyalty to her nation justifiably in question, even with all that, "You're one of the best now, baby," made her smile. She felt an ache to call her father and tell him what had happened. They'd always been close, and when neither of her brothers had followed in his footsteps by choosing a military career, she had. It had just strengthened the connection. She knew he'd understand what it was costing her to turn her back on everything she held sacred to avenge her team. And she had a powerful premonition she would never see him again. Even if they made it through to Jupiter with half the UN fleet hunting them, and even if, when they got there, Admiral Nguyen and the dozen or more ships he controlled didn't immediately blow them out of the sky, and even if they managed to stop whatever was happening in orbit around Io with the Rocinante intact, Holden was still planning to land and save Prax's daughter. The monsters would be there. She knew it as surely as she'd ever known anything in her life. Each night she dreamed of facing it again, the thing flexing its long fingers and staring at her with its 2 large glowing blue eyes, ready to finish what it had started all those months earlier on Ganymede. In her dream, she raised a gun that grew out of her hand and started shooting it as it ran toward her, black spider webs spilling from holes that closed like water. She always woke before it reached her.
but she knew how the dream would end, with her shattered body left cooling on the ice. She also knew that when Holden led his team down to the laboratories on Io where the monsters were made, she'd go along with him. The scene from her dream would play out in real life. She knew it like she knew her father's love. She welcomed it. On the floor around her lay the pieces of her armor. With weeks of travel on the way to Io, she had time to completely strip and refit it. The Rocinante's machine shop was well stocked, and the tools were of Martian make. It was the perfect location. The suit had seen a lot of use without much maintenance, but if she was being honest with herself, the distraction was the payoff. A suit of Martian reconnaissance armor was an incredibly complex machine, finely tuned to its wearer. Stripping and reassembling it wasn't a trivial task. It required full concentration. Every moment she spent working on it was another moment when she didn't think about the monster waiting to kill her on Io. Sadly, that distraction was over now. She'd finished with the maintenance, even finding the microfracture in a tiny valve that was causing the slow but persistent leak of fluid in the suit's knee actuator. It was time to just put it all back together. It had the feeling of ritual, a final cleansing before going out to meet death on the battlefield. I've watched too many Kurosawa movies, she thought, but couldn't quite abandon the idea. The imagery was a lovely way of turning angst and suicidal ideation into honor and noble sacrifice. She picked up the torso assembly and carefully wiped it off with a damp cloth, removing the last bits of dust and machine oil that clung to the outside. The smell of metal and lubricant filled the air. And while she bolted armor plating back onto the frame, the red enameled surface covered with 1,000 dings and scratches, she stopped fighting the urge to ritualize the task and just let it happen. She was very likely assembling her death shroud. Depending on how the final battle went, this ceramic and rubber and alloy might house her corpse for the rest of eternity. She flipped the torso assembly over and began working on the back. A long gouge in the enamel showed the violence of her passage across Ganymede's ice when the monster had self-destructed right in front of her. She picked up a wrench, then put it back down, tapping on the deck with her knuckle. Why then? Why had the monster blown itself up at that moment? She remembered the way it had started to shift, new limbs bursting from its body as it watched her. If Prax was right, that was the moment the constraint systems that Mao's scientists had installed failed. And they'd set the bomb up to detonate if the creature was getting out of their control. But that just pushed the question one level back. Why had their control over the creature's physiology failed at that precise moment? Prax said that regenerative processes were a good place for constraint systems to fail, and her platoon had riddled the creature with gunfire as it had charged their lines. It hadn't seemed to hurt it at the time, but each wound represented a sudden burst of activity inside the creature's cells, or whatever it had in place of cells, as the monster healed. Each was a chance for the new growth to slip the leash. Maybe that was the answer. Don't try to kill the monster. Just damage it enough that the program starts to break down and the self-destruct kicks in. She wouldn't even have to survive. Just last long enough to harm the monster beyond its ability to safely repair itself. All she needed was enough time to really hurt it. She put down the armor plate she was working on and picked up the helmet. The suit's memory still had the gun camera footage of the fight on it. She hadn't watched it again after Avasarala's presentation to the crew of the Rossi. She hadn't been able to. She pushed herself to her feet and hit the comm panel on the wall. Hey, Naomi? You in ops? Yep, Naomi said after a few seconds. You need something, Sergeant? Do you think you can tell the Rossi to talk to my helmet? I've got the radio on, but it won't talk to civilian stuff. This is one of our boats, so I figure the Rossi has the keys and codes. There was a long pause, so Bobby put the helmet on a work table next to the closest wall monitor and waited. I'm seeing a radio node that the ROSI is calling MCRMR Goliath 3-24397A15. That's me, Bobby said. Can you send control of that node down to the panel in the machine shop? Done, Naomi said after a second. Thanks, Bobby said, and killed the comm. It took her a moment to refamiliarize herself with the Martian military video software and to convince the system to use out-of-date data unpacking algorithms. After a few false starts, the raw gun camera footage from her fight on Ganymede was playing on the screen. She set it to endless loop and sat back down on the deck with her suit. She finished bolting the back armor on and began attaching the torso's power supply and main hydraulic system during the first playthrough. She tried not to feel anything about the images on screen, nor to attach any significance to them or to think of them as a puzzle to be solved. She just concentrated on her work on the suit with her mind and let her subconscious chew on the data from the screen. The distraction caused her to redo things occasionally as she worked, but that was fine. She wasn't on a deadline. She finished attaching the power supply and main motors. Green lights lit up on the hand terminal she had plugged into the suit's brain. On the wall screen by her helmet, a UN soldier was hurled across the surface of Ganymede at her. A confusion of images as she dodged away. When the image steadied, both the UN Marine and her friend Tev Hillman were gone. Bobby picked up an arm assembly and began reattaching it to the torso. The monster had picked up a soldier in a suit of armor comparable to her own, and then thrown him with enough force to kill instantly. There was no defense against that kind of strength, except not to get hit. She concentrated on putting the arm back together. When she looked up at the screen again, the feed had restarted. The monster was running across the ice, chasing the UN soldiers. It killed one of them. The Bobby on the video began firing, followed by her entire platoon opening up. The creature was fast, but when the UN soldiers suddenly turned to open a firing lane for the Martians, the creature didn't react quickly. So maybe fast in a straight line, but not a lot of lateral speed. That might be useful. The video caught up again to the UN soldier being thrown into Private Hillman. The creature reacted to gunfire, to injuries, even though they didn't slow it down. She thought back to the video she'd seen of Holden and Amos engaging the creature in the Rosinante's cargo hold. It had largely ignored them until Amos started shooting it, and then it had erupted into violence. But the first creature had attacked the UN troop station, so at least to some degree they could be directed, given orders. Once they no longer had orders, they seemed to lapse into a default state of trying to get increased energy and break the constraints. While in that state, they ignored pretty much everything but food and violence. The next time she ran into one, unless it had specifically been ordered to attack her, she could probably pick her own battleground, draw it to her where she wanted to be. That was useful, too. She finished attaching the arm assembly and tested it. Greens across the board. Even if she wasn't sure whom she was working for, at least she hadn't forgotten how to do her job. On the screen, the monster ran up the side of the big mech Yojimbo and tore the pilot's hatch off. Said, the pilot, was hurled away. Again with the ripping and throwing. It made sense. With a combination like enormous strength and virtual immunity to ballistic damage as your tool set, running straight at your opponent, then ripping them in two was a pretty winning strategy. Throwing heavy objects at lethal speeds went hand in hand with the strength. And kinetic energy was a bitch. Armor might deflect bullets or lasers, and it might help cushion impacts, but no one had ever made armor that could shrug off all the kinetic energy imparted by a large mass moving at high speed. At least, not in something a human could wear. If you were strong enough, a garbage dumpster was better than a gun. So when the monster attacked, it ran straight at its enemy, hoping to get a grip on them, which pretty much ended the fight. If it couldn't do that, it tried to hurl heavy objects at the opponent. The one in the cargo bay had nearly killed Jim Holden by throwing a massive crate. Unfortunately, her armor had a lot of the same restrictions it had. While it made her very fast when she wanted to be, it wasn't particularly good at lateral movement. Most things built for speed weren't. Cheetahs and horses didn't do a lot of sideways running. She was strong in her suit, but not nearly as strong as it was. She did have an advantage with firearms in that she could run away from the creature while continuing to attack from range. The creature couldn't throw a massive object at her without stopping and anchoring itself. It might be ungodly strong, but it still only weighed what it weighed, and Newton had a few things to say about a light object throwing a heavy one. By the time she'd finished assembling her suit, she'd watched the video over 100 times, and the tactics of the fight were starting to take shape in her head. In hand-to-hand combat training, she'd been able to overpower most of her opponents. But the small and quick fighters, the ones who knew how to stick and move, gave her trouble. This was who she'd be in this fight. She'd have to hit and run, never stopping for a moment. And even then, she'd need a lot of luck, because she was fighting way out of her weight class, and one shot from the monster was a guaranteed knockout. Her other advantage was that she really didn't have to win. She just had to do enough damage to make the monster kill itself. By the time she'd climbed into her newly refurbished suit and let it close around her for a final test, she was pretty sure she could do that. Bobby thought her newfound peace about the battle to come would finally let her sleep. But after 3 hours of tossing and turning in her rack, she gave up. Something still itched at the back of her head. She was trying to find her Bushido, and there were still too many things she couldn't let go of. Something wasn't giving her permission yet. So she pulled on a large fuzzy bathrobe she'd stolen from the Guan Chi Yin and rode the ladder lift up toward the ops deck. It was third watch, so the ship was deserted. Holden and Naomi had a cabin together, and she found herself envying that human contact right now. Something certain to cling to amid all the other uncertainty. Avasarala was in her borrowed cabin, probably sending messages to people back on Earth. Alex would be asleep in his room, and for a brief moment she considered waking him. She liked the gregarious pilot. He was genuine in a way she hadn't seen much of since leaving active duty. But she also knew that waking a man up at 3 a.m. while in her bathrobe sent signals she didn't intend. Rather than try to explain that she just needed to talk to someone, she passed the crew deck by and kept going. Amos was sitting at a station in ops with his back to her, taking the late watch. To avoid startling him, she cleared her throat. He didn't move or react, so she walked to the comm station. Looking back at him, she saw that his eyes were closed and his breathing was very deep and regular. Sleeping on a duty watch would get you captain's mast at the least on an MCRN ship. It seemed Holden had let discipline lapse a bit since his Navy days. Bobby opened up the comms and found the closest relay for tight beam traffic. First, she called her father. "Hi, Pop. Not sure you should try and answer this. The situation here is volatile and evolving rapidly. But you may hear a lot of crazy shit over the next few days. Some of it might be about me. Just know that I love you guys, and I love Mars. Everything I did was to try to protect you and my home. I might have lost my way a little bit because things got complicated and hard to figure out, but I think I see a clear path now, and I'm going to take it. I love you and Mom. Tell the boys they suck." Before she turned off the recording, she reached out and touched the screen. "Bye, Dad." She pressed send, but something still felt incomplete. Outside her family, anyone who'd tried to help her in the last 3 months was sitting on the same ship she was. So it didn't make sense. Except, of course, that it did. Because not everyone was on this ship. Bobby punched up another number from memory and said, "Hi, Captain Martins. It's me. I think I know what you were trying to help me see. I wasn't ready for it then, but it stuck with me. So you didn't waste your time. I get it now. I know this wasn't my fault. I know I was just at the wrong place at the wrong time. I'm going back to the start now because I understand. Not angry, not hurt, not blaming myself. Just my duty to finish the fight." Something loosened in her chest the moment she hit the send button. All the threads had been neatly tied up, and now she could go to Io and do what she needed to do without regret. She let out a long sigh and slid down on the crash couch until she was almost prone. She suddenly felt bone-tired, like she could sleep for a week. She wondered if anyone would get mad if she just crashed out in ops instead of going all the way back down the lift. She didn't remember having fallen asleep, but here she was, stretched out in the comm station's crash couch, a small puddle of drool next to her head. To her relief, her robe seemed to have remained mostly in place, so at least she hadn't bare-assed everyone walking through. "Gunny," Holden said in a tone of voice that meant he was saying it again. He was standing over her, a concerned look on his face. "Sorry, sorry," she said, sitting up and pulling her robe more tightly around her middle. "I needed to send out some messages last night. Must have been more tired than I thought." "Yeah," Holden said. "It's no problem. Sleep wherever you like." "Okay," Bobby said, backing toward the crew ladder. "With that, I think I'll go down and take a shower and try to turn back into a human." Holden nodded as she went, a strange smile on his face. "Sure. Meet me in the machine shop when you're dressed." "Roger that," she said, and bolted down the ladder. After a decadently long shower and a change into her clean red and gray utility uniform, she grabbed a cup of coffee from the galley and made her way back down to the machine shop. Holden was already there. He had a crate the size of a guitar case sitting on one of the workbenches and a larger square crate next to his feet on the deck. When she entered the compartment, he patted the crate on the table. "This is for you. I saw when you came on board that you seemed to be missing yours." Bobby hesitated a moment, then walked over to the crate and flipped it open. Inside sat a 2mm electrically fired 3-barrel Gatling gun, of the type the Marines designated a Thunderbolt Mark V. It was new and shiny, and exactly the type that would fit into her suit. "This is amazing," Bobby said after catching her breath. "But it's just an awkward club without ammo." Holden kicked the crate on the floor. 5,000 rounds of 2mm caseless, incendiary tipped. "Incendiary? You forget, I've seen the monster up close too. Armor piercing doesn't help at all. If anything, it reduces soft tissue damage. But since the lab stuck an incendiary bomb into all of them, I figure that means they aren't fireproof." Bobby lifted the heavy weapon out of the crate and put it on the floor next to her newly reassembled suit. "Oh, hell yes." Chapter 47. Holden. Holden sat at the combat control console on the operations deck and watched Ragnarok gather. Admiral Souther, who Avasarala had assured everyone was one of the good guys, had joined his ships with their small but growing fleet of Martians as they sped toward Io. Waiting for them in orbit around that moon were a dozen ships in Admiral Nguyen's fleet. More Martian and UN ships sped toward that location from Saturn and the Belt. By the time everyone got there, there would be something like 35 capital ships in the kill zone and dozens of smaller interceptors and corvettes like the Rosinante. 3 dozen capital ships. Holden tried to remember if there had ever been a fleet action of this size, and couldn't think of one. Including Admiral Nguyen's and Admiral Souther's flagships, there would be 4 Truman-class UN dreadnoughts in the final tally, and the Martians would have 3 Doniger-class battleships of their own, any one of which could depopulate a planet. The rest would be a mix of cruisers and destroyers. Not quite the heavy hitters the battleships were, but plenty powerful enough to vaporize the Rocinante, which, if he was being honest, was the part Holden was most worried about. On paper, his team had the most ships. With Souther and the Martians joining forces, they outnumbered the Nguyen contingent 2-1. But how many Earth ships would be willing to fire on their own, just because one admiral and a banished politician said so? It was entirely possible that if actual shooting started, a lot of UN ships might have unexplained comm failures and wait to see how it all came out. And that wasn't the worst case. The worst case was that a number of Souther ships would switch sides once Martians started killing Earthers. The fight could turn into a whole lot of people pointing guns at each other with no one knowing whom to trust. It could turn into a bloodbath. "We have twice as many ships," Avasarala said from her constant perch at the comm station. Holden almost objected, but changed his mind. In the end, it wouldn't matter. Avasarala would believe what she wanted to believe. She needed to think all her efforts had been worthwhile, that they were about to pay off when the fleet arrived, and this Nguyen clown surrendered to her obviously superior force. The truth was, her version wasn't any more or less a fantasy than his. No one would know for sure until everyone knew for sure. "How long now?" Avasarala said, then sipped at the bulb of weak coffee she'd started making for herself in place of tea. Holden considered pointing out the navigation information the Rossi made available at every console, and then didn't. Avasarala didn't want him to show her how to find it herself. She wanted him to tell her. She wasn't accustomed to pressing her own buttons. In her mind, she outranked him. Holden wondered what the chain of command actually looked like in this situation. How many illegal captains of stolen ships did it take to equal 1 disgraced UN official? That could tie a courtroom up for a few decades. He also wasn't being fair to Avasarala. It wasn't about making him take her orders, not really. It was about being in a situation that she was utterly untrained for, where she was the least useful person in the room and trying to assert some control, trying to reshape the space around her to fit with her mental image of herself. Or maybe she just needed to hear a voice.
18 hours now, Holden said. Most of the other ships that aren't part of our fleet will beat us there, and the ones that don't won't show up until it's over, so we can ignore them.
18 hours, Avasarala said. There was something like awe in her voice.
Space is too fucking big. It's the same old story.
He'd guessed right. She just wanted to talk, so he let her. What story?
Empire. Every empire grows until its reach exceeds its grasp. We started out fighting over who got the best branches in one tree, then we climb down and fight over a few kilometers worth of trees,